Elliot, remember once upon a time, and it wasn't that long ago, that hockey conversations essentially revolved around audits of questionable hits. Like every day on talk radio was, did you like this hit? Was this a bad hit? What's the number on this hit? And this went on for the longest time. Thankfully, that has now calmed down generally, and we're able to actually talk about hockey. But not today. Tom Wilson from last night.
After all! Wilson. Meanwhile, this is thrown out in front, and a backhander is stopped by Murray, and play is halted.
There's blood by the gloves. Zach Aston-Reese was over stick handling. Wilson came in at a high rate of speed, and he lets Zach Aston-Reese have it.
Your thoughts on the hits, your thoughts on the fallout. By the way, Brian Burke will be joining us here in a little while here on the podcast.
I got to tell you, there's a guy in the league who hates Tom Wilson something fierce.
I think there's more than one.
Yeah, just one. Shh. One that I communicate with.
Okay.
And he texted me last night, and he said, I cannot believe I'm saying this, but I actually think this is a clean hit.
Mm-hmm.
I like hitting. I do believe there's going to be a day where a check to the head is going to be an automatic penalty.
Double IHF.
Yes.
Double
I do IHF believe thing. We will go to that day. On the air the other day, I said 5 years. That may have been premature, but it's going to happen. I think the playoffs have proven that there can be hard hitting without illegal head checks. There's one angle of the Aston-Reese that looks okay. There's one
side.
The one angle from behind looks really bad. I'm really torn on this particular hit. I know players hate Tom Wilson.
But here's the thing.
People don't have the stomach anymore for that result.
But the thing is, I think you look at the incident first and the nameplate second.
Yes.
I think what you're saying is people are sick of this result from that nameplate.
Yes, yes. And I think the other thing, too, is that it used to be that there were five guys on a team like him, and that might be conservative.
Yeah.
Now there's nobody. Nobody plays the game like that anymore. You know, he's really come a long way as a player. People just don't have the stomach for that result anymore.
It's remarkable how quickly that has changed, though. Where once upon a time that was, hey, get your head up, kid.
And
hey,
you know Zach, what? I still think that that is a big problem. That players don't expect to get hit anymore.
Well, because it's penalized right away. If you want to talk about no,
or there's no hitting.
If you want to talk about zero tolerance for headshots, I mean, players are taught that at a very young age in minor hockey.
And also, there's so little hitting.
But there's so little hitting, and they sit in the cradle of the officials and supplemental discipline that someone else is taking care of their head. I remember Craig Simpson told me once we were talking about his son Dylan, who was going to, or maybe had already been playing at North Dakota. He's an Edmonton Oilers draft pick, as we all know. I said, as an ex-NHLer, how do you teach your son? Like, what do you impart to your son? What kind of knowledge do you give your son? And the first thing Craig said was, I tell Dylan that no matter where you are on the ice, expect to be hit and compose your body accordingly. Whether you have the puck or not, expect at that moment you're going to be hit. Every time you're on the ice, every area of the ice, expect to be hit. That way you protect yourself. If you get hit, you're ready for it. And if you don't, well, bonus, you didn't get hit, but at least you prepared yourself for it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the McDavid group was the first one, like that McDavid draft class was the first one that really grew up with this rules package, because coming out of lockout 205 when everything was brand new again, here's the new game, it took players a long time to adapt. You had to break a lot of habits in order to learn the new game. A lot of guys did, more guys didn't. They found their way out of the game. Some guys have been able to survive. Some guys have been able to thrive. But we're always waiting for that draft class. And I still maintain it's a McDavid draft. For players that didn't have to break any habits, they just had this rules package and that's how you played hockey. And that was it. They didn't have to stop playing one way and learn another way. And we're at an NHL right now where it is still a game that's in somewhat of a transition. Like, I always made this point. If you're looking at safety, okay, the NHL hockey wants it two ways. They want it fast and they want it safe. You can get there But in getting there, you have to ask yourself a question. How much damage are you comfortable with? Here's the analogy. Elliot, if I told you that from now on, you could only park your car driving 40 miles an hour, you might be able to figure out a way how to do it eventually. Yes. But in the process, you would smash a lot of cars. If I said to you coming out of the lockout, and I think everybody has to ask themselves this question. If I said to you coming out of the lockout, we want this game to be fast to the point where players are skating at 30 miles an hour consistently, and we want it to be safe, there are going to be casualties along the way. How many concussions is that worth? Because it's folly to think that you're just going to flip a switch and all of a sudden you're going to have a concussion-free game when all of a sudden you've taken the speed and you've grown it. We all have a different number, but what's the number you're comfortable with? 500? 700? 1,000? At what point do you say to yourself, we're comfortable with this number because we're going to get it to this speed and it needs to be safe? You have to assume there will be concussions. There will be cracked eggs along the way.
Yes. And I think the other thing, too, is the NFL is going through a big thing right now where they're changing their rules as we speak. And basically it's called the helmet lowering rule, which will for the first time penalize players on either side of the ball for lowering their head to initiate and make contact with an opponent. Now, I understand, Jeff, it's a grinding process because apparently one of the coaches went through there and said that, wait a sec, we all teach our running backs to do this for right. blocking. How are we going to stop this? And the other thing I saw, and Jenny Vrentis of Sports Illustrated wrote a really good article about it, and this was something, Jeff, that I just fully believe this is never going to happen. And she writes that one coach was in there saying, you know what, well, this player on the other team, he's soft, and we can target him, and now we're going to have to teach guys not to do that. I can't see in a million years that happening. One of the reasons that this is such a big deal is, one, it's in the playoffs, and two, it's Pittsburgh, Washington. Those teams, they hate each other so much, and their fan bases hate each other so much. There is not a chance that for the Stanley Cup, coaches aren't going to be telling their players that. Mm-hmm. Like, Jeff, if you and I line up in the third period of a Game 7 for the Stanley Cup, and if you think I'm soft, there is not a chance in the world that you're going to think to yourself, oh, my coach said that guy's soft, go easy. Yeah. Not, or if you're coaching against me and you see Emil on the ice and you're like, that guy is soft as day-old butter outside, you're not going to say, oh, go easy on that guy for the Stanley Cup. Mm-hmm. It's never happening. It's never happening.
I want to get back to your original point. Because I think it is an interesting one. As much as fighting has evolved itself out of the game, yeah. and pretty quickly too.
Yes.
Let's not forget that happened yes. fast. I think that type of hitting is evolving out, and that type of player.
Well, it is.
Is evolving out. I think that's the thing that's unsettling, I think, for a lot of hockey fans. And you touched on this off the top. How quickly we've grown to not be used to that.
Yes.
But that used to be, okay. That's like Wendell Clark every single night. Rick Tocchet every single night. That's the way you played hockey, Cam Neely.
And the regular season misses the hate. It does.
Yep.
You know, the playoffs, they turn it back on. And I used to think that if you put the automatic head-hitting penalty into the game, that it would destroy hockey. Watching the playoffs now, I still think you can have a lot of great hits. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, I think this is going to happen eventually because, look, people say that football is going to die off and hockey is going to die off. I don't believe that because you can still make a lot of money playing it. Like, I have a 6-year-old now. He doesn't play hockey, unfortunately. He can't. But I see the parents. They have the dollar signs in their eyes. There's no way these sports are going anywhere. But the injuries are a factor mm-hmm. in the enrollment in both sports. And you're going to need to take contact away in football before the age of 12. No tackling. And we're already seeing the hits to the head being penalized at a younger age in hockey. The culture is going to change. But the insurance, the pressure, like the pressure of these hits,
yeah.
the sport's going to change. We're going to have to go there.
But the thing is, it's not just head hits. And we have to get Dr. Ali Rendley on the program, who's worked with Dr. Charles Tater before. Interesting story, too. She used to be a runner on Hockey Night in Canada. You remember Ali Rendley. So she's a doctor now. She's a big – she actually used her brain for something. And a lot of her research now involves the brain. And the point that she's always brought up to me is, you know, you hockey guys are silly. You think that concussions only happen when you get hit in the head. She said, I treat more people that get hit in the stomach and get concussions. Your problem isn't headshots and your problem isn't fighting. Your problem is hockey. Like, regardless of where the contact is, it doesn't have to be shoulder to head. It can be shoulder to shoulder. As long as the skull, as long as the brain hits the skull, you're peeling away another part of the onion and you're concussed. Like, it's not just the hit to the head. You guys want to isolate it. And you guys want to say, okay, it's a punch to the head, it's a hit to the head, we get rid of that, and all of a sudden concussions go bye-bye. It's not even close. You can get hit anywhere in your body. Get hit in the back, get hit in the stomach, hit in the shoulder, and you can get a concussion.
Yeah.
The problem's hockey. Like, I don't know that it ever ends up going completely non-contact, but even non-contact hockey, because if you look at the women's game, I mean, Amanda Kessel almost lost her entire career because of concussions. There's no hitting there. It's a rough game. You know, the women walk the line of violence in a traditional non-contact sport, but there's still concussions there. I think you have that many people on the ice going at those elevated rates of speed, people are going to get hurt. Everyone's number is different, as I mentioned. I think as hockey fans, we all have to say to ourselves, how much are we comfortable with? It's a concussion sport.
Yeah.
It sounds awful.
It's a concussion sport. I agree with you. Like, I believe in it. You accept the risk. I'll tell a story that, like, I used to be really afraid of heights. So I wanted to cure that problem. I went skydiving.
I heard that about you.
And people thought I was nuts. And I remember someone told me they knew somebody and they got hurt because the chute didn't open properly. I think they broke their leg. It could have been a lot worse. And they said, like, you know, how do you feel about that? And I said, well, if there's a problem with the chute, that's a problem. But generally, I think you accept risk that something could happen when you do that. I'm a big believer in that. Like, if you're going to do certain adventures, you accept risk. Like, especially now, I remember one of the doctors, one of the judges or the adjudicators in the NFL concussion settlement, I think it was a female, she said there is no player anymore who can sue for concussions.
Because you know the risk.
Because now you know what they are.
Yeah. Hey, I don't need to jump in front of a subway to know that if I do, it won't tickle.
Back then, we're still sorting that out. Yeah. I've had players tell me that they knew, and I've had other players tell me that it was never explained to them the level of what they were going through.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to sort that out. But it's so tough now. Like I said, Jeff, I just think that when you look at Tom Wilson the other night, I think you could make a real argument both ways, but I think that the fans' acceptance of those kinds of injuries in the sports is what the league has to most worry about, because that's your future. That's your ticket-buying public.
And on that happy note, welcome to 31 Thoughts, the podcast, brought to you by the all-new 2018 GMC Terrain.
So I first met Elliot Friedman when we were both up for the same job. He got it. I didn't. But that's here nor there. I don't hold anything against him because now we're co-workers. And quite frankly, two hosts on one show on Wednesday is better than anything I could have hoped for. As for Merrick, what he's taught me is that hockey is food. Cookies. Apples. Snips. Snacks.
Yes.
I don't know what any of it means when I listen to him. But I know that he sounds cool. And when I copy him, my kids think I'm cool.
You Yes, we refer to it when we did the show with when I did the show with George and Bob. We used to refer to that type of language as Sportuguese. We were speaking fluent Sportuguese, only a language that that sports people could understand. Welcome to 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Thank you very much, Darren Millard, host of Sportsnet, and does some ringside on Hockey Night in Canada.
You know what
as well.
That job was that I got?
Yeah, what was the gig?
That was the Hockey Night in Canada job.
He was up for it as well.
The three finalists, as I understand it, in October of 2003. Were myself, Darren, and Bruce Rainey, who was CBC.
CBC, yeah.
Yes, I believe he was the top internal candidate. And there was I worked at the Score at the time when I worked at the Score, Emil. Yeah. And
you did basketball, some basketball.
I did some basketball, yes. And I used to cover basketball. Drink, whoever's listening to this podcast. And Darren, who was at Sportsnet at the time at Rogers. And we were the three finalists. And the story I remember is it was I thought Darren was going to get the job because on the Monday – we did a final interview. There were a bunch of interviews. I think they interviewed a bunch of people. And
I was going to say, what was that interview process like for that? Because I have to admit one thing. I've never interviewed for a job in media.
Okay, that's good. Never. You're lucky. Interviewed. So that process was the Stanley Cup final in 2003 was Anaheim versus New Jersey. And New Jersey won in seven games. And I didn't know it because I was covering the series at the time, but Scott Russell was still at Hockey Night in Canada then.
Yep.
And I guess he said a goodbye sign-off after Game 7. And so Dave Rutherford, who I worked with at the Score at the time, told me, he sent me a note, is Scott Russell leaving Hockey Night in Canada? I was like, I work with you. How am I going to know?
Yeah.
And I was at the game and I didn't see it, but I guess Scott had decided to leave and he signed off that night, gave a goodbye. In the summer, I got a call from Shirelli Najak, who at that time was producing games at Hockey Night, and he said, we have a job opening, and I said yes, and he said, like you, Jeff, I'm not much of an applier. I think if people are interested, they'll come find you. And he said, well, look, I'm not offering you the job, but I want you to apply. So I applied, and I had one interview.
That's a wink, by the way.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't think it was ever a shoe-in. Like, I don't believe that, especially what I know now. I don't believe it was a shoe-in.
Not giving you a spot, but we'd really like you to try out for the team.
Yeah, I think I would have had a shot. I would have had a shot. So I applied, and CBC is what was called a board. So it was four people in the board. It was Shirelli. It was Joel Darling, who then was the executive producer. It was Mike Brannigan, who's here now at Rogers.
Hey, he does junior hockey with me, Brannigan.
And there was someone from
HR, probably?
Yeah, HR. Yeah. And that was where I almost blew the job because she asked me, do you have a temper? And I go, yes, I do, but it's usually generally directed at myself. Like, I don't get mad at other people. I get mad at myself.
Yeah.
And later on, Shirelli told me, if somebody asks you from HR if you ever have a temper, say no. Like, don't say yes. So I did that. And then they called me back for a second interview, which I remember was after, at the time, at the Score, we used to do university football games on Saturday. I don't remember who Guelph was playing, but I remember the game.
Oh, Griffins. Yeah, probably one.
I'm sure they got killed by about 1,000.
Okay.
But the game was at Guelph, and if I remember correctly, it was like a monsoon, too. So I had to go on a Saturday night in September from Guelph football in a monsoon to go do my second interview at CBC.
Right.
And I did the second interview, and that was the one with Nancy Lee. I remember Nancy
Lee. She was head of CBC Sports at that time.
And she challenged me on some of the interviews I'd sent. Like, I sent an interview with Theo Fleury when he was playing in Chicago, and she goes, I thought that was a terribly naive question that you asked Theo Fleury. And, it was good. It was good. Like, it was a good back and forth. I liked it. Like, she challenged me on some of the stuff I did. She goes, that was a terrible question. I explained why I asked it. And then on the Monday was the first day of training camp, and Curtis Joseph had signed with Detroit, and it was going to be his first day at Red Wings training camp, and Joel called me while we were driving, and he said, Elliot, we have something in our process we have to go through, but I'll fill you in later on today. So I assumed that Darren was getting the job, and I was the number two choice, and if they couldn't get the deal done with Darren, that I was going to be the guy. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Then he called me back about a half hour later, and he said, no, we've decided that we can't reach someone, but we want to tell you, you're the guy. You just have to keep it secret. And so I remember I was in the passenger seat of the car and almost drove off the road.
Wow.
And I think what that was they were just trying to tell all the other people that, I was going to be the guy. The one thing I will say about Darren is he was always really good about it. Like, that's not easy. Everybody wants that job, and we all kind of knew who the other guys were. And Bruce was the same way. Like, if one of them had gotten the job and I hadn't, you sort of grimace and you say congratulations, but you're like, that really sucks.
Yeah.
Those guys were all class. And as the more I got to know them, I'm not surprised about it. Bruce, by the way, was
one of the nicest men in the world.
Yes, and
like
he,
going away.
And a god in Atlantic Canada.
Like, sure.
I
it was
believe
rainy?
That his newscast
yeah.
in Charlottetown, and then where I think it was based in Charlottetown, like it was the highest rated CBC newscast by share in the country. Like that's how big.
Really,
yes,
eh?
For a long time.
Wow.
And then eventually he left. But I'll tell you a story about Bruce. We did the Olympics in, I can't remember where it was. I think it was Italy. And he got one travel day to go back, and then he had to go back to work the next day.
So flew back to Charlottetown and then back to Italy?
No, after it was over.
Oh, after it was over. Oh, so only one day and they had to go back to work?
The last night of the Olympics,
I'll let the guy breathe.
We have a big party, and he told me that. I said, how many days off do you have? He goes, one. I travel, and that's it.
Oh,
and I go,
geez.
What? And he goes, yeah, because as it was explained to me, the CBC Sports pays for the replacement for him in Charlottetown while he's at the Olympics.
Yeah.
And once it's over, CBC Sports doesn't want to pay for that anymore. And so,
what is this, the 50s?
He has to go back to work. And I said, give me the phone. And I will concede there was alcohol involved here.
Give me the phone. I'll straighten this out.
And said, give me the phone number of your supervisor because I'm going to tell them how
terrible this is. It's like Reg Dunlop telling Demi Liu to call Detroit.
And he goes,
okay.
I'm not giving you that phone number, which was a wise decision on Bruce's part.
He's a wonderful man. I got all the time in the world for Darren, who, when I came here, 2012, I think. I mean, he's a giant here. He's the face of Sportsnet hockey, him and Kipper. You know, and for the longest time, and you see this at trade deadline, it was always Darren and Nick versus TSN.
Yep.
On trade deadline.
Yep.
It was those two guys stand the bunch.
Yep.
And ever since, you know, those days, and of course, you know, much bigger production now when it comes to hockey, I've always had tons of respect for those two guys because they fought a fight. And listen, for the longest time, you know, numbers were even. And they did a spectacular job fighting that juggernaut at a time where it seemed as if it would have been Davey and Goliath. So thank you, Darren, for that lovely intro. Amelia, you're going to be running out of Sportsnet people in the building here. Pretty soon you have to go downstairs, you know, to the guy that makes our sandwiches, sells us smoothies. yeah, I think I saw Elliot a couple weeks ago. He may have come by. He likes mango. All right.
I do like mango.
Oh, what's not to like? I don't want to make this week's podcast sound like last week's podcast, but I do want to talk about Toronto and the situation there with Lou Lamoriello. But first, I want to get your thoughts on last Saturday, and it was NHL lottery time, and it was won by the Buffalo Sabres, a team that, when you really think about it, we talked a lot about who needs Rasmus Dahlin more than any other team. And I think, I'm not sure if you arrived at the same conclusion, but I said, listen, Buffalo needs this guy more than the Montreal Canadiens, the Vancouver Canucks, the Arizona Coyotes, go right down the list. And Jason Botterill was the happiest guy of the bunch. Your thoughts on what we saw last Saturday and any observations from behind the scenes that, I mean, I was down here on the 8th floor doing the Facebook Live with John. They wheeled in a bunch of GMs, but you were upstairs on 10.
I got more texts about Don Waddell's turtleneck than I got about anything else.
Secret agent man, eh? He looked like a 1970s spy movie guy.
And you know what? Like, that was a great day for Carolina. I'll tell you this. Buffalo needed Dahlin the most.
For sure.
But the team that needed the good news probably as much as anybody else was Carolina. There were a lot of people like joking about Waddell's turtleneck, but I hope, if they're in the lottery next year, he should wear the thing again.
It's lucky.
It's good luck. What stood out? Guys didn't want to be there. You know, there's no question about it. The GMs hate.
Do you think GMs are embarrassed to be there, all pulling together the non-playoff teams?
Yeah,
here are the guys that didn't make it. Hey, guys, put on a nice smile for TV.
The camera goes to you. Like, if you're one of the teams that drops, you're like, and you just want to scream, and you know the camera's on you. I'll tell you this. I think guys are more expecting it to go bad than good. Like, it's sort of like hope for the best but expect the worst for those guys.
Right.
You can tell they want no part of it. But the league wants those GMs there. Like, especially after last year where McPhee took a late flight and missed it. Like, they were mad. So I think the GMs understandably feel that there's a lot of pressure to be there now.
You know, there was – I can't remember who mentioned it online, but someone brought up the idea of not just sending the GMs but sending a couple of super fans with them. to put a more of a positive fan face to the lottery? Because to your point, I mean, there's a lot of upside down smiles on Saturday. Like, I understand the television aspect of it. I understand the showbiz of it. And lottery day has become a huge day, as you've pointed out, in the NHL. So you want all-stars on deck. And the all-stars that day are the general managers. But I do get the idea that, okay, here are all the guys that aren't playing. And before the game starts tonight, which is where all these general managers would like to be, let's see who ends up with the first overall draft pick. So I understand that. I mean, Vancouver floated out the idea of bringing in the mascots.
Well, here's the thing. So this is what happened. So Jim Benning, I heard, said it on radio on our sister station, Sportsnet 650 in Vancouver.
He is Jim Benning, the general manager of the Vancouver Canucks. Well, the good news, we're down here at Rogers Arena, and Finn thinks his chances of representing the team next year, if there is a lottery, just doubled. So I don't know. You'll have to take that up with him, I suppose.
Finn wanted to go this year, but we checked with the league, and they said he couldn't come.
I checked. Is he serious? Because it started appearing on my Twitter feed. People were tweeting it at me. Yeah. And I was like,
is he... Well, tweeted it out.
Well, no, yeah. But I waited. I checked first. I said, was he serious? And we're like, oh yeah, he was serious. So I tweeted out, and I understand the league's position on this. And then I made a joke about it on Hockey Night, saying it cost us the shot of 14 GMs and an orca.
Finn, yeah.
And, Finn was great. He tweeted out some pictures. There's one picture he has of him biting my head when I did the Canucks telethon. And he tweeted out I had my best suit pressed too. It was all fun. But unfortunately, the league starts getting killed on it. And you can imagine they're doing a slow burn. I can only imagine they're doing a slow burn. And then I guess they checked, did the Canucks actually ask for this? And the next day they called me and said they never asked. So whatever was said on radio, the league said that wasn't true. And, in some ways I do feel bad for them because they got the crap kicked out of them on social media when apparently they did nothing wrong. I will say this. I was very frustrated at the end of last week because you know what happened with Brad Marchand. So after game one of Toronto, where he licked Komarov, I remember covering the Stanley Cup final in 2011 where Burrows bit Bergeron. I interviewed Bergeron in between periods, and I asked him what happened. He goes, he bit me. And the league was proactive. They said, no more of this. And they should have been proactive. You do not want that to be escalated into a bad situation. So before game two of Toronto-Boston, I checked and, I just made some calls and I said, I remember this in 2011. I don't blame you for wanting to be proactive. Have you been? And I don't think Marchand was spoken to directly, but I think they did call the team and say, we can't have this turn into a problem.
Yeah.
And
licking.
Because you know what? And I did hear, I was told that some teams had called the league about it. They were like, this is bad. This is not good for us. And it could get really bad because what happens if someone loses his mind and it causes a problem, whatever. And I think there's all sorts of trouble there, potentially all sorts of trouble there. So I was told that they'd called the Bruins. And then when I put it in 30 Thoughts, which was almost 2 weeks later, it blew up. And, Wyshynski called the league to verify it. The Boston Globe called the league to verify it. And it was all verified, and all of a sudden there's, the USA Today is being told it never happened. And, I had one GM texting me saying, you're wrong. I'm what do you want me to do here? And, it's frustrating because I kind of understand why this happened the way it did. But, I get enough things wrong on my own that I don't need that. And I was very frustrated between the whole Finn thing and the Marchand thing. I was very frustrated because I'm trying to do an honest job. And yes, I do screw up periodically, but you try to be honest and I was very frustrated by the end of last week because I felt that the problems were out of my control.
I want to go back to Buffalo quickly before a break. Do you have a thought on Kim Pegula taking over as team president with the Buffalo Sabres, but the Buffalo Bills as well?
First of all, I'd like to say something about Mike Harrington of the Buffalo News. I had to unfollow Mike on Twitter because he fights with all these guys. I was like, I cannot, I don't want any part of this. I've known Mike a long time. I don't think he's a sexist guy. I really don't. I don't believe that. I wouldn't be friendly with Mike if I thought he was. I think Mike is really brusque and abrupt. as a person, and I think it rubs people the wrong way. But I've also seen him be really nice to people, and he's always been super nice to me. And I think that in this day and age, people have trouble handling people who are like that. I don't believe that Mike is sexist. I don't think his comments about Kim Pegula, the way they came across, I read them. I was like, oof, I know where this is going to go. But I don't believe that Mike had any intention of saying that I think this is a bad move because she's female. I think he just feels that it's a bad move.
Because it's an owner. So I think Mike's point was, if it were Terry Pegula, he would have said the same thing.
Yes. I feel bad in some ways for the Pegulas because I remember when they took over the team and how happy people were in Buffalo. Yes. They didn't like Golisano, and they were like, all right, like, here's some people we're going to spend. And what did they do? They threw money at people.
They threw money at Erhoff.
They threw money at Leno. They also threw money at Tyler Myers, who was the rookie of the year. And Jason Pominville
beefed up for scouting, so just doing video.
Yeah, to his credit, admitted to me that that caused problems on their team. Because the guys who were there felt that the guys who weren't there got to make all the money.
Right.
And I will always be impressed that on a camera, Jason Pominville was willing to admit that. Because I didn't think when I asked the question there was any way he would. I just think the Pegulas, they thought that Buffalo would love them if they just threw money at things. And at the beginning, it did work. But it didn't go. And I think that what happened is they have spent a lot of time trying to dig out. And everything they've tried just hasn't worked. Remember when they hired Rex Ryan, people were ecstatic.
Yep.
And it didn't work. You know, I think they realize that the slow way might be the right way. I just think that the concern is that they should have the team at arm's length. Now, I also realize that this whole situation with Russ Brannon, I don't know what's going on. I've read the reports.
Internal investigation
yes,
is the reason.
Like, I mean, so, as an owner, that can throw you into
yep.
for a loop and you just have – but the fact that the report is that Kim Pegula is going to be president for good – it's not that she's not a hockey person. I don't care about that. I think different perspectives are good. I just think with everything they've gone through as an owner, I think being that close to the team is a bad idea.
See, I understand the motivation. And I can remember that press conference and seeing Terry Pegula with tears in his eyes when he sees Gilbert Perreault. I think we can all, and we can remember this is sitting beside Gary Bettman and saying, listen, I'm not in this to make money. If I want to make money, I'll drill another oil well. As Bettman is sitting there thinking, you know, there might be a lockout coming up here. We're just going to put a button on this type of conversation. And we've seen it countless times. And I can understand the instinct. If you're the Pegula family, you understand the instinct. Here's something that you love. You love the Buffalo Sabres. And your first instinct is, I need to come here and do something.
Absolutely.
I get that it's hard to sit back and say, you know what, maybe the smartest thing is for me to do nothing. But I've bought this thing to try to fix it. I'm going to have a real hard time taking a back seat on this. I'm going to have a hard time, you know, sit in the back seat saying, you know what, the best thing for us is to ride out a process. I want to try to fix this thing as quickly as possible because now the Buffalo Sabres have a resource they didn't have with the other owner, and that is money. So I'm going to throw money at it.
Yeah.
I get it.
Mm-hmm. All they wanted to do was do the right thing for Buffalo.
Yeah.
Their hearts were always in the right place. I think that you need another perspective there is what I would say.
All right. We'll step away briefly. When we return, you will hear from – you can always tell how famous someone is, Elliot, on television, whether you have to font them or not. our next guest, you do not have to font.
When I was at the Score – we always said, why are we fonting Michael Jordan?
No need to font our next guest.
You know what? You can put a name, but you don't need to put a like Bulls guard. Like that's what we used to argue again. We created a font that didn't have a second level for Michael Jordan. So you can just put Michael Jordan.
The man who needs no font, Brian Burke, next on 31 Thoughts the Pod. The all-new 2018 GMC Terrain is the compact SUV thoughtfully designed with you in mind. With features like the Traction Select system to revolutionize how you adapt to the road, a fold flat front passenger seat to give you up to 8 feet of cargo space, and an innovative electronic precision shift system to make shifting easier than ever, the 2018 GMC Terrain is truly mighty like a pro. GMC, we are professional grade.
Come on in.
Ryan Burke is here. Don't know why. Why would he be here?
Is there another question in here from someone else?
To move this team takes one phone call. One phone call. 25 cents in a payphone to move this team.
I'm not a very patient person. I think everyone knows that. I was born impatient, and I'm going to die impatient.
There's no way Alex Hall was going to be on this team this year unless he flew to France during the summer and bathed in the holy waters at Lourdes.
This is crazy here. It reminds me, when they asked me about doing 24-7, I said, we already do it.
Sedin is not English for punch me or headlock me in a scrum.
Days and weeks go by where I don't wonder what John Tortorella thinks about our team. I can promise you, it's been since January 18th where I've worried about it, and I'm not going to worry about it tomorrow. I don't know why he seems so worried about our team when he should be worried about his team. You know what? Shut your mouth and worry about your team. Leave my coach alone.
The Pittsburgh model. My ass.
Everybody in the city knows more about running that hockey team than you do. You know, I get in the cab and the cab driver would say, your power play sucks. And I'd say, drive faster. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you're telling me how to do my job.
If I was worried about my image, I would have done a much better job about it before I got here. I'm not going to change. You ask me a question, I'm going to answer it. You ask me, do you like this tie? If I don't like it, I'm going to tell you I don't like it.
We all have our favorite lines by Brian Burke. I've got a handful. Elliot, I'm sure you have a handful as well. Brian, this is one of my favorites. This is from some years back when Brendan Shanahan ran the Department of Player Safety. He said to me during a radio interview, Brendan Shanahan has the worst job in the world. And I said, why is that, Brian? He said, because he wakes up every morning and everyone in the league thinks he's an idiot because no one will agree with him. True or false?
True.
You held that position once upon a time. Did you wake up every morning and think to yourself, everyone thinks I'm dumb?
Yep. And if it involved a Montreal player, you were stupid in two languages.
Now, hot button issue, and this goes back to last night, the Tom Wilson hit. At the time of this recording, there has not been a ruling yet on a suspension or non-suspension, but there is a hearing. So, and we have to give Elliot Friedman credit on this one because this is all Elliot's idea, although, Brian, you will be the star of it.
Mm-hmm.
Reprise your former role here.
Let's do a hearing.
Let's do a hearing.
Let's do a hearing.
Okay, I will play the role of Tom Wilson.
I will play the role of Brian McClellan, GM of the Washington Capitals.
And you will play the role of George Parros.
Which a role you did several years ago.
Yep.
So walk us through how this happens.
It would start with a preamble from the Department of Player Safety. George would read a preamble, which I'll do some facsimile thereof. Then he will ask the player for his version of what happened. Then he will ask the GM, Brian McClellan, his version of what happened. He will ask for the medical report or read it into the record, the extent of the injuries to the player. That has to come from the club physician, by the way. The GM can't file it. It has to be objective, independent evidence of injury. And they go to great lengths. Player safety will call a doctor and say, you need to fax that to me right now or give it to me over the phone. They ascertain the exact status of the player. And the team knows if they lie about that record or exaggerate it, they're going to get fined big time. So it's good. They'll ask for the medical report. They'll ask the union then. The PA sits in on the hearing. They ask the union, is there anything in terms of fairness? Now, the union's in a tough spot because they represent both players.
Right.
They represent the victim and the defendant. So they usually just raise up some procedural points that the player has never been suspended before and so on. They'll ask the agent for anything he wants to add, usually a testimony about what a good person the player is. So we can start if you want. The preamble reads something like this. I don't have it in front of me, so I apologize to George, but it reads, good afternoon. The purpose of this hearing is to examine the incident which occurred in last night's game between Pittsburgh and Washington in the light most favorable to the player, Tom Wilson. There are no rules of evidence. You can introduce any evidence you want. There is no time limit. You can introduce as many witnesses as you want. The entire purpose of this is to examine this incident in the light most favorable to you. The union's role here is somewhat limited because they represent both players, but they are here to make sure that the hearing is carried out fairly. So, Mr. Wilson, I'll ask you to go first. Please tell us what happened last night. Don't go too quickly so I can take notes, and we will look at the tape together when you're done.
All right, so Jeff is playing the role of Tom Wilson.
Well, Mr. Peros, first of all, thank you very much for allowing me here today. It's much appreciated. I'm very appreciative that I'm allowed to give my give my side of what happened yesterday. Last night as I was coming up the ice, I saw Zach, who, by the way, is a wonderful guy. We do things in the off season with the Players Association together. Really fantastic human being and someone that I would never want to hurt. I wouldn't want to hurt anyone, as a matter of fact. He was carrying the puck up the ice, and my intention was to finish my check shoulder to shoulder. No intention, nor did I think that I left my feet or jumped or lunged at the player. I feel awful that there is an injury. I would never, ever try to hurt anybody. That's not the type of player I am. That's not the type of player my mother and father raised me to be, and I've always liked to honor them in that fashion. I would never want anything to happen to Zach like that.
Okay, and that is about how the player would portray his case. He was just trying to finish his check. Now, I'll interrupt. This is where George can ask a question or two.
Okay.
And what I would ask you is, explain the eye contact issue here to me, if you could. It looks to me like the player was well aware you were coming.
He knew that I was coming. At that point, I realized that this was going to be a legal check. He saw me coming. I thought that he would brace for contact, like happens in the normal course of a game, happens all the time. I didn't try to take advantage of him. I thought that he had seen me coming, and that's when I decided to finish my check the way that I did, which I believe was shoulder to shoulder.
Okay, thank you.
Would I be interrupting, like, on his behalf, or no. Am I not allowed to do that?
Well, you can interrupt, but you wouldn't.
Oh, okay.
It would be the player making a sincere pitch.
Okay.
And you know, we're lucky. We do, most of our players, they might dress it up like you just did, Jeff. Most of our players are just trying to finish their check, you know, or we'd have way more hearings. So now, Mr. McClellan.
Well, I got to tell you, I think this whole thing is ridiculous. There was no penalty on the ice. The player saw him coming. Tom Wilson is 6'5". Zach Aston-Reese is 5'10". You know, I think this is only an issue because it's Tom Wilson. I think it's also only an issue because there was a controversial hit one game earlier, which our player received no hearing. I think this is also only an issue because the player unfortunately was injured. Nobody wants to see anyone injured. And although our rivalry with the Penguins is fierce, we're disappointed that Aston-Reese will need surgery. But there's nothing that says to me that this player should be suspended. It's only an issue because unfortunately he was injured, and it's a high-profile playoff game with a player who's got a history and a team that is complaining about our player.
By the way, that's exactly what Brian McClellan would say, with one exception, where you say it's ridiculous we're here because George Peros would introduce you right away and say, well, I don't think it's ridiculous that we're here, so proceed.
Okay. Would George Peros say that, or would Brian Burke say that?
No, George Peros would say that. I went through a hearing with him.
Okay. I would, if you said that to me, I would say, I apologize. I'm emotional.
Yeah.
I would say Tom Wilson is a very important player for us. He has worked hard. He has met with the league many times. And he got suspended twice earlier this season, but those were both in the preseason. We haven't had an incident all year, and we feel that a suspension of Tom Wilson, which would be driven by a situation that was not where we feel he's at fault, would have a huge detrimental impact on the series, so I am emotional.
Yep, and by the way, those is exactly the arguments Washington's going to make. He's not really a repeat offender or has not been in some time. There was a prior incident which has colored the water here or, you know, confused things. Added to the background noise and so on. So then I, as George Peros, would say, okay, I'm going to read the medical report, which has been submitted by the Pittsburgh team physician, go through the injuries. It's a broken jaw and a concussion. And again, there's severe penalties if they dress these up, so these would be factual. I would then ask the agent. I don't know who Tom Wilson's agent is, but I would ask him. Usually the agent would say, hey, this is a great kid. I've known him since he was 16. Mm-hmm. He's never been in trouble. He went through junior without much trouble. His pro career, very little trouble. If he's married, he's got kids, he doesn't want to see this kind of hockey. And then I would ask the union if there's any points of fairness that they would want to touch on. And then I would say to Mark Guy, so then I would say to the player and the agent, thank you all, and I will render a decision later today. That would be the end of it. But that, for the listeners, that's exactly how they work.
Mm-hmm.
There shouldn't be any mystery to it. The one difference between when I did it and how they do it now and my son Patrick is with the Department of Player Safety. I should have made that disclosure at the start. The videos they do explaining their decisions or non-decisions are excellent. I wish we had done that back in the day.
Okay. Now, how long would an average hearing go for? Because we just did that
just
one
like
in
that.
5 minutes.
It would be five to 10 minutes. Yep.
Really?
Just like that.
I assume that they would take
wow.
hours with all sorts of evidence brought in and stuff like that.
I'd say 20 minutes would be a long one. Because this is really all the evidence is the player's version.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We'd look at the videotape together, so it would add another 5-6 minutes. And George would say, look, you could say you didn't leave your feet, but to me, I think you did.
So they would look at,
they would look at it
with the player as well.
Yep.
Okay.
So about 20 minutes, a really contentious one. Like I sat through the Todd Bertuzzi hearing with Steve Moore.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was 25 minutes or 30 minutes. So for people who are listening, that is about how they go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, almost precisely how they go.
So then put yourself in the role of George Parros. And, of course, he works with, you know, you mentioned your son, Damian Echevarria's in there, Ray Whitney's. Like, there's a number of people that are in there as well.
Before we ask for a number.
I'm not going to offer that.
Okay.
I just want to know, like, what you saw in that video in your previous role. Because there's two views of this thing.
Yeah. I will comment on it after George rules. There's two issues for me. One, I just left a team, and if I'm Brian McClellan, I'm pretty sure I don't want Brian Burke's view if he's still with the Calgary Flames. I've been gone 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
Two, my son works there.
Mm-hmm.
Three, I respect George Parros. I may criticize or critique his decision. I'm certainly not going to try to influence or predict the outcome here.
How much pressure, outside pressure, is there? Like, does Bettman ever call? Does
Never.
An owner ever try to call you?
They're not allowed to.
They must try.
I did this for 5 years. So I was Gary's right-hand man when I went to the league in 1993. I was the first hockey guy he hired. And I will tell you, in 5 years doing this, not once did he interfere. What he would do is he would sometimes stop in the morning and say, look, I got a real angry call last night from the owner of Chicago Blackhawks. It's in your hands, but I don't, just so you know, they think it's something serious. And that would be as close as he would come just to let me know he'd gotten a call. He never once said, I think you got to do this. He never once said, I think that's too light. He backed us up on everything. He's a great boss, by the way. You know, like, I know people in Canada don't like Gary, but not only is he a brilliant guy and all that, he's a great boss. He's got your back. He cares about your family. So, no, he never interfered. Owners did call and write. I got some horrible letters after. I got death threats. I suspended Kovalev my first year at the league, and I got two death threats from disgruntled fans.
Hmm.
One was some drunk idiot, probably someone in the media. But the other one was kind of chilling. It was a Brooklyn accent, and the guy knew where I lived.
A voicemail, you mean?
Yeah, he knew where I lived. He knew exactly where I lived. He knew the route I followed to work at 5:30 in the morning, because I used to go in really early. And then he knew where my gym was.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to come up behind you and put one in the back of your head. You won't even know what hit you. So I got hate mail. I got... this one idiot from Maryland, no matter what I did, what decision I did, I must have really pissed him off about something with a Capitals player. But no matter what I did, I got this profanity laced, you know, you're an idiot. And from this one guy, I got one time I suspended Shane Cherla when he was playing in Dallas. And they put my telephone number and fax number on the Jumbotron. If you disagree with this decision, here's how you reach Brian Burke. So Dave Nonis and I are in the office one night.
In Dallas,
in game. So Dave Nonis and I did another game that night. We come back after a Ranger game or something, and the phones start ringing. First guy from Dallas, he goes, I think you really messed up Shane Cherla. I said, well, sir, you're down to your opinion. And another phone rings. And so finally, like the fourth one, I said, how did you get my number? He says, hell, it was on the Jumbotron. So I called their PR guy. I said, do you think that's a good idea, really? Now the fax machine starts humming, too. People at home that can read it on the Jumbotron are starting to fax me notes.
Oh, my God.
We got a petition signed by several thousand people, and this one was the hit on the Lemieux hit on Chris Draper.
Yes.
We got a petition signed by a bunch of people in Chris's hometown that Lemieux should have got more games and I should get fired. So, yeah, it's a pressure-filled job. George Parros has a difficult job, but he's got the personality for it, because you just have to tune out all the critics. No matter what you do, you're going to be wrong in the eyes of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It's like the goaltender interference calls. We gave it to Toronto. Everyone says, oh, now all the controversy is going to go away. No, it's not. There's seven or eight moving parts on those calls. Solomon could start making the calls, and it wouldn't matter.
That's the figure skating element of it, right? That's where interpretation comes in, and this is a 7.8, and this is a 5.2, and this is interference, or this isn't interference.
And there will be people who watch last night's game and say it should be 10 games. I saw a commentator on TV said, well, if they gave 10 for all of these, they'd stop. Well, we don't want to do that. We want these things to stop, but if you're too hard, then the hitting disappears. So if you said anything like this, we're going to give 10 games, well, then you're going to stop having body checking.
I don't believe that anymore. Brian, like the playoffs have been phenomenal. I think the hitting has been really hard. To me, it shows how different the regular season is from the playoffs. The regular season, I think there's a lot of games now that get kind of coasted through, for lack of a better term. The switch flips in the playoffs. The hockey is entertaining. But I am more convinced than ever, Brian, watching the playoffs, that you can have a hard game and hard hitting, and most players can avoid hitting the head.
I agree with that, but you didn't let me finish.
Yeah, sorry.
I think that, first off, you're dealing with the hitting will disappear where a player is not sure, and he says, well, maybe I'll do this or whatever. And when you take out even 10% of the hitting, you might as well have taken out 30% of the hitting. Mm-hmm. So we're saying the same thing, question of degree. But my point is, someone will say it's worth 10. Someone will say it's worth 2. Mm-hmm. Capitals fans, they'll say it's worth nothing. Mm-hmm. There is a weighting system on playoff games. All right, so the notion that one regular season game is the same as a playoff game, no, it's not. Never has been. Mm-hmm. And I won't tell you what the weighting system is because I don't know what it is, but it's certainly 2-for-1 in the first round. So if it's a four-gamer in the first round, it's not going to be more than 2. It's a minimum of 2. Mm-hmm. And it went up. I think in the finals, our unofficial rule might have been 4 or 5 to 1. So Lemieux might have got 20 games for that. He got 4 instead, and they missed games in the finals.
I remember in 2007, Pronger was suspended 1 game, right? So you're saying that that probably would have been a 4-game suspension in the regular season?
Yeah, Coley screwed us on that one.
As I remember, you still won the Stanley Cup.
No,
was that the McCammon hit?
Yes.
Chris Pronger got suspended in the conference finals against Detroit.
That's
and
right.
He hit Thomas Holmstrom. And that one we thought Coley messed that one up. But on the McCammon hit, it was definitely a suspension. And I told Coley that we got no defense. In the hearing, we said we have no defense. Mm-hmm. We have nothing we can offer in defense of this hit.
One of my favorite stories involving you and your previous capacity, and this isn't certainly your first hearing, but it's one of my favorite stories. The Marty McSorley, Eric Lindros situation.
TV replays appeared to show Lindros bite Marty McSorley last night during the Flyers-Sharks game, but upon further review, Lindros and the league said today, there was no biting. You judge for yourself. Lindros and McSorley in a fight in the third period. Bob Lee leaning ever closer to that TV set. Lindros had his mouth open. There appeared to be a brushing of the face. The NHL said, we saw nothing.
I don't know what else you want me to say.
How would you bite somebody in the head? That's pretty tough to do.
Put the mouth guard in, too. I mean, it's kind of tough. There's no truth to that.
Brian Burke is reviewing it. I'm sure he's going to talk with Eric and with Bobby Clark and with our management, and I think it's best that we let the league handle it and let the league make a comment about it. I think that's the way I would want it handled if I was in a situation like that.
As it was explained to me, this is completely flipped to how conversations go now, where you're begging for the suspension and you'll say whatever to get the other guy suspended. True or false? You called Marty to say, this is when Lindros had allegedly bit him during a fight.
And denied it.
Mm-hmm. And the way it was told to me is, you said, Marty, I can't do anything unless you say he bit you. And he hummed and hawed, and all Brian, things happen in a fight and I'm not sure. And at the end of it, Marty said something along the lines of, Brian, he didn't bite me, now call Bobby Clark and tell him he owes me one. Is that true?
True story. The linesman couldn't ascertain that he bit him. So he came out of the fight saying, hey, he bit me, and then thought better of it later. But the linesmen were like, we didn't see a bite, so there's nothing we can do. So I called him and said, I'm perfectly willing to suspend Eric Lindros for biting you. You've got to tell me that he bit you. You know, there was a code back then, and Marty said no. He said, he didn't bite me, but you tell Mr. Snyder he owes me one. It's a true story.
Did he ever collect?
I should ask, you know what, I bet, knowing how hockey players remember everything, I should ask Eric if he remembers that, too, because I bet you he does.
For sure.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah.
So here's a question I want to ask you. You've joined us now for the playoffs. Is your executive career over?
Hopefully.
That's it?
Yes.
And you're a media guy full-time now?
Well, I don't have a full-time gig. I'm only under contract for this round and the next round.
But that is your desire?
Yeah, I'm trying to make a career switch here.
Which panelist do you want to remove from the show?
Well, I think all of them deserve it. But no, that's up to, I mean, I don't know. Like, the sum total of the discussions I've had with Sportsnet were about these two rounds. I don't know whose contracts are expiring. I don't know whatever. But, yes, it's my intention to make a career shift.
Okay.
So, in your mind, you've checked as many boxes as you'd like in the NHL?
Yeah. And I'm sick of the commute. Like my daughters are going to be here no matter what. They're 14 and 12, so it's not like they're 1 year away from graduation. I want to spend more time with them. So, yes, my plan is to make a career shift and go over to the dark side.
Mm-hmm. So if some team, whether it's Seattle or someone else,
nope.
Done.
Now, there are a couple owners I really like in this league. Mm-hmm. Most of them not. Mm-hmm. Most of them I'm indifferent about or don't like.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple situations I would have to think hard about given the people involved, but they involve commuting too much, and so I think the answer is no.
Okay.
I wouldn't rule out anything. I taught law school for 10 years. Now, a lot of people don't know that. When I worked for the Canucks, I taught at UBC Law School. I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
Might do some of that. So I don't know. But, yeah, my plan is, and I've said it publicly, and I'll say it again right here, my plan is to make a career shift and go over and do broadcasting if someone thinks I'm good enough at it to give me a job.
Okay. You know, you had a love-hate relationship with the media during your time. Brian and I went through a period where we didn't talk for a year. It kind of makes me laugh in some way because I don't think you can do this job correctly, media job, if you're not occasionally battling somebody. But does it make you laugh that you're joining the media considering how you battled with us, many of us, for some of our careers?
I heard from the NHL indirectly after the first period of the first game I did for you guys.
Which was me and David Amber.
Yeah.
And I bet you I know exactly what that was when you said the first soft penalty call of that series, Tampa-Boston, was soft.
I hadn't done one period in my fledgling career without getting reprimanded. So I know I'm going to be on the wrong side of a lot of people doing this. It's never bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
The people whose opinions truly matter to me, I count on two hands.
Mm-hmm.
And their family and close friends and longtime friends and mentors.
Mm-hmm.
And I did an interview with Sportsnet in Vancouver this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And James Cebulski said at the end, he said, well, sure, we won't always agree with you. I said, well, I don't care if you agree with me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way I can do what I do as an executive or in the media. I don't care if people like it or agree with it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say this is what I think. If you don't like it, too bad.
Just by the way, Jeff,
yeah.
Every time I hear Cebulski, when we worked together at The Score, Cebulski was doing a live hit once, and Brian body checked him almost. I don't think he realized he was on the air at the time. You almost broke his collarbone. It was the funniest thing we'd ever seen.
I did not mean to hurt him. Obviously, I was just finishing my check.
We made eye contact.
I was taller than he is. Bigger heels on. And
we'll see who needs to be represented in that hearing.
Well, the one thing that we do know about you is you have a very unique gift when it comes to the language and the words that you choose. And there's a number of – I mean, you're one of the most quotable people this game has ever seen. One of the great ones, I mean, you can't say truculent without thinking Brian Burke. You know, that whole – when you went on that routine, was it truculence?
Pugnacity.
Testosterone.
Huh?
As soon as you said that, I thought of Tom Watt. And Tom Watt used to have a saying about his blue line. Said, I want virile, agile, hostile, mobile, dancing bears, is what I thought. Before you said that, is that something you would think of and write down, or is that all top of the mind from Brian Burke?
No, if you go back and look at that, that was at the press conference when I was announced as GM of the Leafs, and I just had like four speaking points on that. And my teams historically have played with truculence. I believe it's an essential element of the game. I think our game is poorer for it now as it's filtering out. I think the game suffers. I agree with Elliot. That's why the playoffs are exciting. And you say to yourself, well, why do we have to wait till April to get this level of hitting and body contact? So I think the way my teams played was the right way and the entertaining way. And so I talked about pugnacity and truculence. But the whole truculent thing is I use that word in Vancouver describing a player, I didn't think it was a little used word. I thought it was a commonly used word. Well, all the reporters there told me they had to go and run and get a dictionary. And I'm like, and our coach, Mark Cropper, was our coach. He goes, truculence. He said, I never heard that word before. I like that word, truculence. So some of the stuff is thought out. So you come out. You're waiting for me after game, and I'm a coach. And the coach says, well, we weren't very good tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I might say, tonight we couldn't knock a sick goat off a stump, which is what our high school football coach would say to us when we were lousy.
Yeah.
Okay, which quote's ending up in the paper?
Yeah.
Mine. So they say you're colorful, you're this, that. I don't sit around and think these things up, but I am emotional, and the quotes usually come from right from the heart. Like, you know, that's how it works.
I asked Jack Edwards this last week, and he was a great podcast.
He was really good.
And we asked him, is there anything he regretted doing? And he said, or that someone said to him, Jack, come on, like, that's too much. In your career, is there anything that you really regret?
I'm sure. I'd have to think about it, but I'm sure there is. I mean, I wish I hadn't gone after Kevin Lowe like I did.
I was gonna, have you guys made peace?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is actually a story about Brendan, about my son.
Mm-hmm.
And so one night, Kevin Lowe and I, we went fishing together years ago at Langara Fishing Lodge up in the Haida Gwaii. And I like Kevin Lowe, mm-hmm. and I respect Kevin Lowe. But what he did just was so stupid to me, mm-hmm. and I fried him, and then he challenged me to a fight on the air. Mm-hmm. He said, Brian Burke, anytime, anywhere, and I'm like, okay, first off, Kevin Lowe's not afraid of me. Kevin Lowe's not afraid of anyone. That's the type of people we are. That's how we made it as hockey players, and I'm not afraid of Kevin Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was a cowardly way to ask for a fight. So we went through the whole barn thing.
Yep.
So people get confused by this. I never called Kevin Lowe and said, I'll run a barn, let's fight. I called Slats.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Slats, your former protege challenged me to a fight last night on the radio. That's not how you challenge someone to a fight. Here's how you challenge someone to a fight. I want you to call him and tell him, August 2nd and 3rd, I'm going to be in Lake Placid at that under-18 tournament that USA Hockey runs. I'm staying at the Holiday Inn. I'll run a barn. I'll kick his ass. I'll drive him to the hospital, and we'll both go home. Well, my ex-wife overheard the whole conversation. I thought she was upstairs. I was mm-hmm. out in the backyard of Newport Beach in my house because the cell phone worked better in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Slats called Bettman or my ex-wife called Bettman. She said, you've lost your mind. You're going to get in a fist fight with Kevin Lowe? And I'm like, hopefully, if he shows up. So I never made the challenge to Kevin, but someone called the league, and Bettman called me and said, I hear rumors you're trying to stage this fight. I'll suspend you both for longer than your contracts. Mm-hmm. So that was the end of the fight. Brendan heard me ripping Kevin to someone on the phone, and he said, who are you talking about? I said, Kevin Lowe. And he said, didn't he used to be your friend? And I said, yes. He said, well, I don't approve. Why do you carry on these grudges? I said, Brendan, we're Irish. I expect you to carry on these grudges, not just me. So after Brendan's accident, I called Steve Tamlin, and I said, you tell Kevin we got a fence to mend, and we've done that. So.
Where does the barn come from? Because that really, like, from a lyrical point of view, and they say this culture has no poets, but I mean, throwing the barn in there.
Well, you need a
really,
place to
really,
fight.
Really was the moment they captured the spirit of the
fight. But
thing.
They kick you out of most bars when you get in a fight, so you need a place to go where you can fight.
Livestock's not kicking you out.
Yeah, so.
The bouncer might. I want to ask you about a first, and you and I have talked about this on the air before, but for the listeners from this podcast, I want you to share what's going through your mind. This is first-year general manager Brian Burke with the Hartford Whalers, and it's your first trade. It's Bobby Holik for Sean Burke and Eric Weinrich.
Eric Weinrich.
Yeah. Kipper says you're his first trade.
I think Kipper might have been the first.
Kipper was the first?
Yeah.
So let's make it Kipper. What happens in your very first trade? Because there's you and there's the phone. That's it.
Right.
There's no internet. There's no, to my knowledge, assistant general manager, VP of hockey operations. There's not a whole lot of support staff around you.
Well,
what's it like making that first deal?
I think Nick was my first one, but that one we were pretty comfortable on because my coach said we had to get him. Paul Holmgren said, this is the one guy you got to get me if we're going to play Brian Burke hockey,
right?
Paul Holmgren hockey. We had a tough team that year too. But the first big one was Bobby Holik for Sean Burke and Eric Weinrich. And Sean was our MVP that year, and Eric Weinrich was our second-best defenseman. So it was a really good trade for us. And you got to remember, I went into Hartford on the heels of the worst trade maybe in the history of the NHL, certainly in the history of the Hartford Whalers, which was John Cullen and Zarly Zalapsky for Ulf Samuelson and Ronnie Francis. So Lou Lamoriello was the GM in New Jersey, made the deal. First off, I was late for my first GM meeting because I had to talk to Sean Burke first. I said, before I make this deal, I got to talk to Sean Burke. He didn't finish the playoffs as the starter in the IHL that year in San Diego. Rick Knickel was the starter. Mm-hmm. Sean backed up. So I said to Lou, I need to speak to Sean Burke before I'll do this deal. So I was late for my first GM meeting, so I was up talking to Sean Burke, and I came in, and I remember Phil Esposito just gave it to me. Way to pay attention to the job, rookie. You know, it's your first meeting. Like, and I couldn't tell anyone what I was doing, so it was really embarrassing. But I went to call Lou, and I started to dial the phone, and I put it down. And I picked it up and started to dial again and put it down. And finally, I said the third time, I said, you got to have some jam here. Make the deal. And I picked up the phone and called him. But I did three tries.
So what goes through your mind after you hang up the phone, though? Like, you've just completely changed Bobby Holik's life, Sean Burke's life, Eric Weinrich's life.
Well, I was saying the rosary that I hadn't screwed up because that was my first big deal. I'm like, God, I hope I didn't screw that up. Usually when you hang up, you're like, yeah, I just fleeced that guy. I just took him. and I just skinned him. And he's hanging up thinking, hey, I just skinned that guy. So it's I think the younger generation, when I became a GM, it was Lou Nanny and Bill Torrey and Cliff Fletcher. And it was a pirate mentality. The ideal trade was one where you skin the other guy.
Yeah.
And I think my generation and guys after me, it's more, let's try to make this work both ways. If it doesn't, too bad, but let's try to make a deal that works both ways.
So once upon a time, you had to count your fingers after you shook hands.
Oh, yeah, these guys. Sure. And there's still guys like Bob Murray's like that in Anaheim. He's a pirate. Bob Murray's a pirate. He'll enjoy that I said that on the air, too, because he revels in being a pirate.
You mentioned that general manager's meeting. Now, was that the GM meeting? 93? So that would have been Gary
Bettman's.
I went
there in the summer of 92.
So would this have been the GM meeting when Bob Gainey and Serge Savard rolled up the sleeves?
No, that was.
Because you were there for that one, right?
I was working for the league at that one.
And was that Gary Bettman's first GM meeting?
It was certainly not the first one, but it was Jeff Pash was still there too. And Jeff said to me, it looks like they're going to fight.
This is Gainey and Savard.
Gainey and Savard. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Jeff Pash said to me, it looks like they're going to fight. And I said, yeah. I'm thinking, great. He's like, what are you going to do? I said, well, we'll have to move some tables. And he's like, maybe, I don't think Gary appreciated that. Maybe you ought to break it up. So a couple of us broke it up. But at first I'm thinking, we got to give these guys some room anyway. Move a few tables.
Let's get an eyeball here for a couple of
shots. Were there any other close fists? Actually, the one I heard was that they got ugly was – after Philadelphia and Washington had that fight where who was it that Ray Emery beat up? Was it Holtby? I heard that George McPhee and Holmgren had a nasty exchange.
Well, they might have because they could both still fight.
Yeah, they're tough guys.
Yeah,
Paul Holmgren's tough guys.
Yeah. Paul Holmgren's my age. He looks like he could still play.
Mm-hmm.
And I fought Paul Holmgren in a summer league in Minnesota, and it was a bad decision on my part. It seemed like a really good idea at the time. It ended badly.
I heard that one was a potentially.
I heard that too, but I don't remember seeing it personally.
Yeah, I heard it was and George is also in still really good shape. Like,
yeah, and George punched out a coach.
Yeah, Lorne Mullican.
Lorne Mullican.
Yeah, preseason game. Right. That's right.
In Columbus, I think it was, at a preseason game.
He called me the next morning. He said, I think I might have screwed up last night. I said, what happened? He told me. I said, what do you mean you think you might have screwed up last night?
Who was, then, in your opinion, and we're talking about just straight down, stick down, gloves off, toughest player you ever saw?
Toughest player I ever saw. If you go back, the heavyweights fought each other, and they all won some and lost some. I would say the guy that was the king of the hill for the longest time for me was Bob Probert.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give guys fights when he didn't have to. You know, he'd give guys fights late in games when they were trying to make their mark. And
you know, that's interesting they mention that, because one of the things that a lot of fighters will talk about is, especially in training camp, preseason games, kids will try to make a name, and the vet's not going to do it because if he wins, he's supposed to. If he loses, holy smokes, he just lost to a kid. But Bob wasn't shy. Bob always would give a guy a chance, no matter what level he was at, no matter, you know, he's trying to impress the coach, whatever it was. Bob was always, you know what, someone did it for me,
so
I'll do it for them.
Yep. I never knew Bob Probert. I met him. It would be a great exaggeration to say I knew him, but mm-hmm. I met him several times. Obviously, in this line of work, you meet everybody. But I would have to say, you can argue that there were tougher guys. You can argue that there were bigger guys. The fact is, if you go back and analyze it, the only way you're not going to lose a fight is if you don't try to win it. So the guys that actually throw punches and try and win fights, they're going to eat one once in a while, get on the wrong side of the fight, and end up losing the fight. And unless you're willing to do that, then you're just going to be hanging on and whatever. And I've talked to Brian McGrattan a great deal about this. And, of course, we've taken fighting virtually out of the game. And I'm not a nostalgia guy. I don't want to go back to when I played in the American League. I think we emptied the bench the year I played for the Flyers farm team. I think we emptied the bench seven times, including once in the conference finals.
That was Maine.
That was Maine. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go back to three-hour games and multiple fights every night and everything. I just think the amount of fighting we have now to keep things, keep players accountable, it's maybe lower, a little bit lower than it should be, but certainly the trend to take it out or get to the point where now you go to four games and see one fight, I'm not in favor of that.
Hartford, I know you were there a brief amount of time.
One year.
1 year. Were you there when Forsberg for Pronger was on the table?
No. So I drafted Chris Pronger in 93, and I left about a month after that. He never played for me. So I had a falling out with the owner, and he was about to fire me, and I called Gary and said, are you still looking for someone at the league? And that's how I made the shift over. That was later, but I will tell you, the one that was, well, I'd have to get this straight. It's funny you ask about that, because I was thinking about this last night, because I was at the draft, and the GM of Ottawa was Randy
Sexton. He's in Buffalo now.
Yep, good guy. Mm-hmm. Played at St. Lawrence. Randy Sexton asked me, would you do, it must have been Forsberg for Sundin. Mm. They had a chance. They were talking about that trade because Sundin was still in Quebec. I said, yeah, I would do that. I said, we're making a deal for Pronger, but I would do that if you get a chance to do it. I remember at that draft, I'd have to think when that was, but first year in Ottawa, it had to be after that. It had to be at the league because the first year I was in Ottawa, the GM was Mel Bridgman when I was in Hartford. So, and this was Randy Sexton, which was after. So I must have been at the league when he asked me if I would do it.
I think we can all, speaking of trades, one of the, well, this would have been a draft. When you took the Toronto job, one of the first things you said was, we're going to do whatever it takes to get John Tavares.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Remember that? Where
I forgot
Toronto
about
is going to get. What was the thinking behind that one?
Well, Islanders had the first pick, and I had called Snowy, and I said, what are you going to do? He said, well, we haven't even decided who we're taking yet. And everyone thinks John Tavares was a consensus number one pick, when in fact, his skating was very average in junior. There were a lot of teams that had him two or three. I just felt the vision and the compete and everything, I really felt he was going to be the best player from that draft down the road. I was right. Just like I told Morgan Riley, we had him rated number one, and he's so far been the best player in the group of five anyway. You could argue guys behind him, Hampus Lindholm maybe are better, but in the group of five.
Not as far as defensemen go, yeah.
And in that group of five. Yep. No one's going to take Forsberg at five. There's a guy who's a late bloomer, and late enough bloomer he got traded, for God's sake. But anyway, so I said to Snowy, I called Snowy, and I said, all right, is there any way you'll trade me this pick? And he said, no. I said, well, that's stupid, Snowy. What if I offer you 10 first-round picks? He said, are you offering me 10 first-round picks? I said, of course I'm not. But I'm asking you, if I did, you'd have to consider it, right? He said, and Snowy's a good guy, and he's a tough guy. And he said, well, I'd have to consider. I said, well, I'm not. But I said, what if I offered you 5 first-round picks? Would you do it? And he said, no. I said, well, of course you would. Who wouldn't take 5 first-round picks for this? Again, this is not Rasmus Dahlin. This is not a lock. This is a good prospect. Of course you'd take 5. But I'm not offering you 5. Would you take 3? And he said, no. And I said, well, I'm not offering you 3. But of course you'd take 3. And then when I said publicly, we are going to try and move up and get the first pick, and someone said, well, who would you take? I said, John Tavares. And Snowy's like, well, now you box me in. Don't call me again. So he wouldn't take my call right up till the draft.
Was there a moment in Toronto where you said to yourself, we're in trouble here? Like, this might not work. I know how confident you were and how much you believed you could do it.
Well, first off, if you want to talk about mistakes, we should have protected the lottery, protected the pick on Phil.
Mm-hmm.
We actually talked about it. And we were like, there's no way we're picking top five. Like, we really felt he would add to our team. We were improving.
Mm-hmm.
We actually talked about it. And we were actually terrified more of it being the Taylor Hall than Tyler Seguin. Taylor scared us more than Tyler. They both scared us. But Taylor Hall petrified us. And we're all like, no, we are comfortable enough that our team will not finish in the bottom five. We're going to do this deal.
Did you think Boston would have walked away if you would have tried to lottery protect it?
Or yeah.
Top five protect it?
Back then, lottery protection wasn't really in vogue. So I think we talked about it briefly, but they were like, no, you make the deal or you walk. And again, now it's standard lottery protection. Back then, that was a while ago now. That's, 10 years ago now?
Mm-hmm. So that would have probably been the first one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the problem was when I went through the interview process here in Toronto, I told Larry Tannenbaum and I told the teachers' pension board, the guys that were on the board, I said, you're looking at a 5-year rebuild. And I'm not going to say that publicly because I hate guys that do that.
Mm-hmm.
I hate guys that stand up on the first day and say, it's going to take 5 years. Well, I'm just buying 5 years of failure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I told them privately it would take 5 years. Problem was the number of no trade, no move clauses, and the one-way contracts at big money and the term. So just to shovel out the stable and get rid of all those guys, it took more than 2 years. And we made the Kessel deal. That backfired us a little bit with the pick, but I'd do that deal again. Phil was excellent here. And I'm so glad he's vindicated his time here with two rings in Pittsburgh. But no, there's lots of things I'd change. The one thing I'd change while I worked here was Brennan's accident. That's the one thing I'd change.
You know, Brian, I remember that week. You guys played in New Jersey the night before, and Saturday we all found out. And, you know, honestly, I still don't know what to say when I see you now. My grandparents lived it. You know, how you doing? Like, how's your family doing?
Good. Everyone's good, thanks.
Yeah.
We had a family meeting 3 days after we buried Brennan, and I said to Katie and Patrick and Molly, you got two choices when something like this happens.
Mm-hmm.
You either sit down and cry and feel sorry for yourself, and it ruins your family. And this happened to relatives of ours that lost a son. It destroyed their dad's life and his relationship with them. Or I said, you keep putting one foot in front of the other, and you keep marching ahead. I said, well, I'm marching, and so are all of you. Mm-hmm. We're all marching together, and we've managed to do that.
Jeff and I were talking about this before. When we hear Patrick doing those suspension videos.
So good.
Like, I close my eyes and I'm like, that's Brian talking.
Yeah, he's got a voice just like mine. That started in high school. He'd answer the phone and say, hello, Burks. And someone would say, hey, Berkey, it's Lats. And he's, oh, I think you want my dad.
He should, you know what? I can't believe that guy wouldn't have pretended he was here for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, just to see if he could get something good.
I got stuck when I was working for Vancouver. And these guys from Quebec would call and say it was Rajon Ouel. And I was riding the bike, and the exercise bike, in the basement of my condo. And the reception's terrible, but it didn't fit in the condo, so I had to put it in the garage. So I'm down there riding the bike, and the guy says, hello, Brian, it's Rajon Ouel. Can you talk? So I get off the bike. I'm huffing and puffing. I go out, and I go, yeah. He goes, let's make a trade. And I said, well, I'm perfectly willing to talk about trade. I hate my team. I'd trade half these guys. Well, it's two pranksters, and we're doing it on some radio station in Quebec.
Well, that's like when they had the trade call, when they first went through sat after the Lindros deal, and all the GMs would call and pretend to be Ron Caron and make up phony deals on the trade call until I think Gary Bettman had to say, hey, guys, let's put a leash on the puppy here.
Just want to mention, though, the Jim, I just got a text, and Sky was coming out, but Jim Montgomery is going to be the next head coach in Dallas.
Jim Montgomery is.
He's a good coach.
Yeah.
Before we do, and we got about 10 minutes, I do want to ask you about You Can Play. You talked about marching, and you march proudly, as have I. I do wonder why it's taken so long. I do have a pet theory about it, though. I wonder why it's taken so long for an NHLer to be comfortable enough to come out. My pet theory is players are always told not to be a distraction. Don't be a distraction. Anytime they do anything extracurricular, don't be a distraction to the team. And I think that is so reinforced early on in a player's career that by the time they hit the NHL, they think it will be a distraction and I can't do that. Do you have an idea why players haven't been comfortable enough yet to come out?
Yeah. Well, first off, the distraction theory is, if you want to know how close to the heart that is, When Brendan told me he wanted to come out, I said, no way you're coming out in the middle of the season. You got to go to your coach and make sure it's not a distraction for your team.
Hmm.
And then you come out when the team says it's okay, you come out and I'll back you up 100%. But you're not coming out in the middle of the season unless the coach says, fine. Rico Blasi is a coach at Miami. He said, no problem. Go ahead. I think the real reason is, and I get this all the time, because I do a lot of speaking on behalf of the LGBTQ community. They'll say, it's too bad no one's been comfortable enough to come out. And I don't think it's a comfort zone based on the fans or our players. I think our players would readily accept a gay athlete.
I agree.
The issue is, the reason gay men don't come out, it's often, most often, based on what gay people tell me, not my experience, there's one close family member that they're terrified of the reaction, whether it's a mom, dad, or a close uncle or aunt, and they're worried that they're going to be excluded. Like Covenant House, which houses homeless youth, it's 40% LGBTQ. These are kids who the parents threw out when they said they were gay.
Yeah.
Hi, Mom, I'm gay. Pack your stuff and get out. Imagine in 2018, we still deal with ignorance and bias like that. So that's what stops most people. And I've had guys come out to me that I barely knew, and they said, I got to tell someone.
Right.
Like, that just won't help you. I'm not part of your life. You got to come out to someone that you can confide in and grow that circle. So you come out to one person, then it's two, then you gradually grow that circle, and then you're openly gay. So I think it's that. It's a dad or a mom or an uncle or a brother,
mm-hmm.
and the guy's terrified of that reaction. That's what usually stymies it. Mm.
That's a perfect way to end. It's been a delight. Thank you for spending close to an hour with us. We thank you for the hearing. I know you don't want to give a number. But we thank you for playing Sheriff. We won't ask you to play Executioner. Best of luck in the new career.
Thank you.
We very much look forward to it. I think we all do, Elliot.
Yeah. Unless it's my chair he's taking, then I'm really not looking forward to it.
You don't want to be a host, do you? Right? You don't want to host.
No.
Stay away from that. Use analyst, space, opinion. Yep. Show up. Give your opinion. Brian, thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Tired of subscribing to multiple streaming services to get your sports fix? Introducing Sportsnet Now. Live stream the entire Stanley Cup playoffs, the Blue Jays, Raptors, and NBA, Premier League, MasterCard, Memorial Cup, and much, much more, all in one subscription. You can stream on the go or at home on your big screen from the most popular devices, including smartphones, tablets, Apple TV, Xbox, and Chromecast. Sign up for as long as you want and cancel whenever you'd like. Get the best bang for your buck with the sports streaming subscription that gets you the most content. Visit snnow.ca for more details. Okay, Elliot, that was, of course, Brian Burke, who's now with us at Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. You know, one thing that we sort of breezed through, we sort of drove through what might have, should have been a stop sign, was the threat story. Ryan Burke getting death threats. Don't know too many general managers that get death threats.
Well, the thing that
he gets threatened on Twitter a lot, but death threats is the next level.
Well, what's the biggest one? Remember with Chelios Bettman in the one lockout?
Oh, in 94, yeah. Better be careful
and
of his
Chelios
kids.
Chelios walked that back.
That was bad.
But Burke doesn't get rattled by a lot of stuff. The thing that took me about that story is he was rattled by it because the guy knew where he was going.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I once had a piece of racist mail left in my mailbox once. And I hope my wife doesn't listen to this podcast. I never told her about it. That was the closest I ever came to that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I've moved now, so I'm not telling you this guy. I'm not telling anyone where I live anymore. But that was the most shaken I got, and not so much because of the hate mail. Like, you get that on Twitter. Like, we all get that, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, was it wasn't addressed to my house. Like, they obviously knew where I lived, and they put it in the mailbox. It said Elliot Friedman just on the envelope. So somebody came to my door and put it there. And that I didn't like. That shook me a bit because, you know, your wife's there, and I can't remember if my son was born at the time, but he probably was. But the guy saying, like, I know this route, I know that route, like, that would shake. Even, like, a tough guy like Burke, that's going to shake you.
It's funny, too, because he laughs about it now. I mean, I guess time heals.
How long has it been since he was in that position? Probably close to 20 years. Yeah. So there you go.
It would take me a long time to laugh about something like that, even what you're talking about.
Like, I laugh about it now. But at the time, I didn't tell my wife.
Yeah.
I didn't really tell many people, but it shakes you, no question.
So thanks to Brian Burke for popping by the podcast today. Much appreciated. And still, we left a lot of stuff on the table. He's got some interesting takes on Germany as a hockey force that he's talked about for a number of years, and we're starting to see it now in the NHL. He was ahead of the curve on that, but we'll have to get him back on the podcast somewhere down the road. Meantime, a few things to clean up, a few things to go over before we get to some Ask 31s. Ron Francis terminated. Contract terminated with the Carolina Hurricanes. It is officially done. That, with the dovetailing news that Rick Dudley has been named the VP of Hockey Operations.
Yep.
Coming into a clearer view, what's happening in Carolina now?
I think it sounds like they're not going to hire another person right now. So, I mean, it looks more and more likely that Waddell's going to be the GM. Not 100%, but I think it's trending in that direction. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was interesting to me that Steve Greeley was in there for a second interview and they couldn't get a deal done. To me, like, they're getting the crap kicked out of them right now, and I reach a point where I'm not interested in piling on.
Yep.
You know, every year it seems as if we get a test about where the league is going. Like, will a different way of thinking be introduced to the NHL? Look at what's happening in Major League Baseball. We've got, I think there's six teams on pace to lose 100 games this year, this early in the season, because they all see what the Astros did, and they're all going to copy it.
Right.
Analytics have made the play of baseball worse. I am a huge baseball fan. I can't watch it this year. For the first time ever, we had a month where there was more strikeouts than there are hits. Between that and the pitching changes, I can't stand it. Analytics has made basketball better. Like, the three-point drive game, I think, is a better game.
Mm-hmm.
More exciting, I believe. But we're really about to get another test on how it will change hockey. Tom Dundon, the owner, is going to be the biggest force in that organization. And, you know, like, we're going to see if it works or not.
See, I'm always interested in things like this. I was interested in what happened with the Florida Panthers a couple of seasons ago that did the full court press with this style of roster composition. I like it because, and I think this is a sort of, I'll use it in a different context because, you know, Noam Chomsky uses this quote vis-a-vis politics, but I think it applies to sports and a lot of aspects of life as well. I'm going to butcher the quote, but it goes something like, innovation is never a gift from above. It's the product of a struggle and a fight from below.
Yeah.
Like, don't ever expect, you know, new thinking to come from people that are already on top. It ain't going to happen. They're interested in maintaining that spot. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Innovation comes from below, from underneath. It comes from the guys and girls on the internet that are doing this. That's where that revolution starts. That's where the innovation happens. So I'm always interested in that test. And there's various gatekeepers along the way. There's various adopters, and there are people that are quick out to point where it fails, where those people go silent when it actually works.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I've talked about this before. Don't cheer for teams. Cheer for players some.
Cheer, you know,
and cheer for chaos. And I cheer for ideas. Mm-hmm. And I cheer for new ideas. And I cheer for innovation. I'm with you. I don't know what it's going to mean. But this is that next rippling from underneath. Don't expect it from up top. Asking those guys, okay, what are you going to give us next? Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is how you have to make it to the NHL. And this is how we're going to behave. Not interested. I'm interested in new ideas, and those come from underneath.
A lot of me is curious to see, can it work? I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's still to be determined, what does this mean for the way the Hurricanes scout?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean for the way they're going to do their roster?
Now, why wouldn't someone like Eric Tulsky be given more of a voice?
You know,
there?
I got to tell you, I think he has a lot of voice.
I think he does too, but why not? We talk about general managers. Where's his name in that conversation?
Well, I have wondered if they would just.
He's head of their analytics department.
Yeah,
I would
wonder now if there's any chance they would make him the GM. I have wondered that. Like, you've got Waddell there, you've got Dudley there. Like, one of the reasons I think that Ron Francis was let go was because Dundon asked a few people on his staff for input about some players that they were thinking of acquiring at the deadline or around the deadline, and none of them knew about it. And I don't know this, but I would assume that Tulsky was one of the people he asked. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if that is something they are considering.
Tulsky as general manager.
Or as a higher position.
Yeah.
like a more authoritative position. And for those of you who don't know Eric Tulski, I think he's a really smart guy. I read his stuff for a long time. He interviewed me once. But I found his stuff always to be very smart and reasonable. Like, some of the stuff out there is not reasonable. His stuff is very reasonable. I wonder if...
I like him because he's a curious guy. Yeah, like, I like people that are curious and don't have their minds made up about
And, you
stuff.
Know, the thing I worry about that is that, look, we all believe that Kyle Dubas is going to be the GM of the Leafs, right?
I'm getting there next, Elliot.
Okay, I'm sorry. So there are people who are going to take runs at Kyle Dubas just because.
Yep.
Eric Tulski, it would be the same thing. People will take runs at him because he's different.
But see my previous point. Innovation comes from below.
Well, I think that he would get a chance to stand on the merits. And if he got the job, like, I would hope he would get a chance to stand on his merits. I think if he was surrounded by the right people who could teach him, you know what? I'd be curious to see what he could do. I really would.
Okay. You mentioned Kyle Dubas. Here we are a week later, and I'll ask you the same question. The focus is sharpened. The pencil is sharpened on this one. Lou Lamoriello, no longer general manager. Elliot, what next?
We're all wondering about the Islanders. Like, you know, I do think there will be opportunities for him.
You don't think there's any chance that he stays in a senior advisor?
He could.
Capacity?
Like, if he doesn't see anything he likes, he could. I'm sure they're not paying him too badly. Toronto has some financial reserves. But, you know, I think he wants to be involved. I know that his philosophies drove some people crazy, but I think he was the right guy at the right time. I believe Dubas will be the next general manager.
By the way, do we know if Marlies players have started to grow beards yet? Now they lose out and the Marlies are still in the playoffs?
That's a good question.
Audit on that one. Have to check on that.
I'm as much curious about is, assuming Dubas does become the GM, what happens around him? Like, who are the guys there? You know, is Mark Hunter going to stay? I think Mark Hunter is an important part of what they do. He finds players.
Yeah.
As good as Zach Werenski is and as good as Ivan Provorov is.
Noah Hanifin.
And he still has a chance to be good, really good. That decision, holding off Babcock and picking Marner, could turn out to be one of the most important decisions in the recent history of the franchise. It would help them if they could find a way. But I also got to wonder, is there another seasoned executive that they're going to look out for? Like, Kyle Dubas has a good relationship with Ron Francis.
Sault Ste. Marie.
There's Chuck Fletcher, you know, was looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
Is that someone they're going to add? I don't know. I honestly have no idea. What would they do?
James Myrtle brought up an interesting point of The Athletic, talking about if it is indeed Kyle Dubas, do we start to remove the word safe from a lot of the Maple Leafs decisions? I mean, you can look at the last couple of seasons and a lot of the acquisitions and a lot of the moves. And even though at the draft, and I think this is Shanahan's first draft, he told all the scouts, stop with the safe pick, swing for the fences. And that's when they went with William Nylander. For the longest time, Maple Leaf scouts, you know, were happy just to make the safe pick, the guy that you know is going to play some games in the NHL. That way the scout can say, my guy got into the league. I did what I was told. I got a guy into the NHL. And Shanahan said, you know, what's that famous, you know, financial book, Safe as Death, or Good as the Enemy of Great, Safe as all that. I said, swing for some fences. And that was William Nylander. And you mentioned, you know, taking Mitch Marner over Werenski and Provorov and Hanifin. You know, those weren't safe, but that's the draft. But outside of the draft, you can look at the Maple Leafs and say, you know, under Lou Lamoriello, they've kind of played it safe. If it is Kyle Dubas, does that spell the end of the safe mantra and now we're going to take more risks? I.e., if we're going to be great, we have to stop being good.
Well, I think Lamoriello was there at a time where they had to kind of play it safe because it was squirrely before that. Like, it wasn't going in the right direction, and he stabilized it. Look, like, what do we know about Dubas? The draft he ran, he traded down twice and then got Dermott, right? Yeah. He added more picks. That is something that he really believed in. It was a different strategy at the time. He made the Kessel deal. He fought to include Murray. Couldn't get him.
Sam Riegel.
He fought to try and, I believe Dumoulin was the other guy he really fought for. Couldn't get him. But he believed in Kapanen. He believed really, and now that kid looks like he's going to be a real find. And that was a really complicated deal that they went back and forth on, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think people portray Dubas he thinks differently, but I think he's worked really hard to also understand the way that the business already was and how to marry the two. Like, he's out scouting a lot. You know, he's trying to learn things. I think he'll have different ideas, but I also think he's being painted as something that he might not truly be, and that is more radical than he really is.
See, the interesting thing to me is how he's going to be criticized based on his background. See, even though there's a strong, you know, belief in advanced statistics, I first met Kyle when he was a junior agent with Uptown.
Yeah,
he's been an agent. He's gone through junior hockey, so it's not as if, you know, here's someone who, you know, had some really cool charts and graphs on the internet and got hired by a team because of how he modeled the franchise. This is still a guy that's gone through, you know, all the various traditional gatekeepers of hockey. Like, well, how did you get here? What are the we just talked to Brian Burke a second ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian was an agent.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Stasek, I think, might have been his first client. You know, it was that big, you know, college free agent that Detroit signed. I mean, it's not as if Kyle Dubas doesn't have a traditional hockey background.
Absolutely.
He's done a lot of traditional hockey jobs. I just don't think he's done it in the traditional way.
But no,
that's great.
But I think what he's done is he's looked at the traditions of the sport and say, okay, what can I learn from this and what can I change from this? Like, to me, Tom Dundon is a full-on disruptor. He looks at that and he says, no, we're changing all this.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people really like to be called a disruptor. And I think Dundon, if you look at his business history, he's like that. I don't think Dubas is a disruptor. I think he is, I don't even know what the right, an evolution person. Okay, I take what you have, and how can I evolve it? How can I take it to the next step?
Mm-hmm.
How can I go to the next level? What's good about your business? Okay, that's good, and I'll use it, but I'm also going to try to evolve a few other things. Like, I don't think he's as much of a disruptor as people paint him out to be. That won't stop people from painting him out that way, though.
The interesting thing for Dubas as well, though, the guy in a lot of ways, both he accepts criticism but doesn't keep it. Like, he doesn't hang on to it.
No, you can't.
And he understands that that is part. Like, as noted great philosopher David Lee Roth of Van Halen once said, Elliot, if you stick your head up above a crowd, someone will throw a rock.
It's then, you know what the bad thing is, Jeff?
What's that?
Nobody threw a rock at Scott Oak the other night.
He did stick up. You mean the mayor of Winnipeg?
That was an awesome hit. What a great
That's
hit.
Fantastic. Okay, really quick, a couple things. Minnesota, if it's Paul Fenton, squirrel finds a chestnut. I believe that Jack Ferrara of LA
yes.
goes with him.
You know what? It's funny. I checked around because you let me know about that, and then you tweeted it. I checked around, and there seems to be a lot of truth to your theory.
Okay, so we'll stand by there. Ottawa, the coaching staff is back like a vertebrae. Your thoughts?
Back like a vertebrae. That's pretty good. I got a lot of mixed reaction to that. Like, I had some people who were surprised and had other people who said they weren't surprised because Ottawa being, you know, a tightly run organization wasn't going to pay for a bunch of guys not to work.
Yeah.
So I got a reaction on both. I thought it was interesting. They've changed around their bench. Rob Cookson will go from Eye in the Sky to the bench. Martin Roman will go upstairs.
Yeah.
Guy Boucher takes over the power play. I'll tell you this. When I heard that they let go of Kirk Kleindorf, their AHL coach, I wondered if they were going to put Mark Crawford there because he was a Belleville guy.
That's right, and the family has a history with the McFarlanes.
Yes, I thought that that's what they might do. Like, Troy Mann, who got let go in Hershey, his brother works for Ottawa, so mm-hmm. I think he's got a shot at that job. In Belleville. I'll tell you this. I know Kirk Kleindorf got a lot of grief. I had guys who told me, you know, Philip Schlappick, he took a big step this year.
And Boucher's going to be expected to play a lot of these kids.
Yeah.
I know he played a lot of them down the stretch.
Took a big step there, I heard.
Thomas Chabot.
Like, I know there were some people who told me that they felt some of the veterans played too much. I can tell you that some of the guys who scouted Belleville said that Kleindorf did a good job with their prospects.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they all got better. I had guys who told me that Chabot wasn't ready for the NHL, but they understood the pressure Ottawa felt to get him up there. They understood that. But they said that in the long run, White and Schlappick, if they make it, they'll be better off for the year. Like, I had guys who told me that they felt that that Kleindorf thing was unfair. But they said that Ottawa did it because they want a younger guy there.
All right, let's get to some. By the way, the vertebrae line was an ICP rip. Just so we're
okay, it was funny. Kind of, that's
a good line.
So what a groan.
I just sort of remember that a second ago. Okay, let's get to some Ask 31s. From Monoliths, what are the conditions of the Ottawa pick? Can they trade down, say, to the Rangers at 9 and then give that pick to Colorado? Very creative, sir or ma'am, but no. And they have right up until that moment, Elliot, when they go up on stage to surrender that pick. But as you
sounds
mentioned,
like they're keeping it.
It sounds like they're keeping the
pick. You know, I'll tell you something.
Good move, bad move.
Well, you know, I gotta say this. I think the trade offers are going to be really interesting. Buffalo's not trading their pick, but I think that even from 2 on down, I think there's going to be offers. I don't see Carolina trading the pick either. I think it's more likely they keep the player. But I do think Montreal is going to get tempted, and I think Ottawa is going to get tempted. And then I think Arizona will be interesting because that's after where the three forwards are likely to go.
Yeah.
And then I think Arizona is going to be in a spot where teams will be calling them too. I think 3, 4, and 5 are going to be fascinating.
Don, who would be the 4 players you'd invite over to sit on the couch, have a couple of ginger ales, and watch a game with and just talk hockey?
Kevin Bieksa, Crosby, Erik Karlsson.
Really? Hey, why?
Karlsson is one of my... Every time last year in the playoffs, as Ottawa was doing great,
yeah.
every time I spoke well about Erik Karlsson, David Amber would send me a text like, geez, enough already.
Get a room.
Erik Karlsson would be on my list. I'm a huge Erik Karlsson fan. And who would be my 4th?
Brad Marchand.
You know, Marchand might be up there. Like, I think he would be.
Drew Doughty?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great pick. You know, Doughty, like, I want guys who kind of leave a little bit secret. Like, Bieksa, as much as he gives it out publicly, he's got that mischievous side. Crosby, you know, there's a lot more there than he lets on. Mm-hmm. Karlsson, I think there's a lot more there than he lets on. You know who?
Mark Scheifele.
Yeah, Mark Scheifele would be good. But you know who I'm beginning to think the answer might be? Like, the guy I'd like to see really what he's like. There's 2. I'm making it 5.
Wow.
Henrik Lundqvist.
Steely blue eyes.
I want to see, like, when he lets his guard down, really lets it go. Yeah. And the 5th is Dustin Byfuglien.
Yes. Yes.
So my 5 would be Bieksa.
Byfuglien.
Byfuglien.
Sure.
Karlsson. Lundqvist. And Crosby.
All right. Here's one that asked for some advice. Keith27NYR. Just graduating college with my bachelor's degree in business this semester. Congratulations, Keith. My passion is NHL hockey. It would be a dream of mine to tie both of them together as a career, but I'm not sure how I can do that. Was curious about what you guys thought. It's another getting into hockey question.
First of all, good luck. And that's the number one thing I say. Secondly, social media now. You have no excuse not to start on your own.
All the tools are there.
Have a podcast, have a blog.
Yep.
Just don't make your podcast better than this one.
I know, that's tough.
Use the available tools of social media. And the question I always ask myself at the end of every day is, did I do everything I could today to get ahead or do something? Was I lazy or did I put that extra 2% in? You know, you have to do something to get yourself noticed, and you have to be willing to make the effort and go to law. There's a lot of people out there who want to do this. So I think start a podcast, start a blog, do your own thing, be you, be creative, put a lot of effort into it. Treat it like a job.
Mm-hmm.
Other people out there, what are you going to do to separate yourself from the other person? And be you. Like, you know, whatever you're good at, put that into the blog or the podcast.
It's tough, too, because a lot of it is you need to know people and you need to get acquainted with people and you need to know people in the industry and know people in the business at various levels. And, you know, to be honest, like, it's hard.
It is hard.
Getting into the NHL. It's tough. And you know what? You know who's done a great job of it? Rachel Dorey in New Jersey.
Yeah. She's got a job now with the Devils. Yeah.
She's worked hard and went up through, you know, junior hockey, worked the Sudbury Wolves, doing video, and now she does video with the New Jersey. Like, there are stories like that. Like, now more
well, look,
encouraging things.
Who have we talked about
so
this podcast? Kyle Dubas did not have a regular path.
Yep.
Eric Tulski was a chemistry professor or something like that. He worked in college, I think in the chemistry department or something like that. Sorry, Eric, if I've got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can take untraditional paths.
The industry's much more accepting of non-traditional paths now than ever before.
Like, the guys who created South Park, you know how South Park got started? They made an 11-minute clip, if I remember correctly, and they sent it around. And a bunch of, like, TV executives or executives in Hollywood started emailing it to each other and said, have you seen this? And that's how it got started. You know, you can do that now.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you going to do that's different?
Keith, we wish you luck and thank you for the question. Question from Andrew Remick. What's with Bergeron getting tossed from the faceoff dot so much in the playoffs? It seems like this rule is undefined and no explanations are ever given. Hashtag Ask31.
It's funny, I'm going to talk about that tonight because the Leafs started all this, eh? When in Game 5 in Boston, when Babcock complained about Bergeron. Yeah. I know it's a big thing about Don, drop the puck. Is it not happening a lot in these playoffs where guys are being thrown out?
Yeah. But that's not the officials themselves. That comes from a directive above about getting a clean draw, to which I always, and this might be just, you know, treating, you know, dandruff by decapitation. But... you know, I've very much in the past couple of seasons been of the mind, if you want a clean face-off, start with the puck on the ice. Just get rid of the drop. The problem is the drop. If you start with the puck on the ice, have the sticks in place, and then blow a whistle, A, the linesman's out of the way, and B, the sticks are going to be in place, or else you're sitting for a penalty. The problem is you're anticipating the draw, and that's where the cheating happens. So you can do one of two things. You can live with something that's not going to be perfect. You are not going to get a clean draw. It's not going to happen. So set your expectation there. And if you're uncomfortable with that, then consider putting the puck on the ice to start. And for all of you people that say, no, I'm a traditionalist, I like the drop, that's how faceoff started. They started with the puck on the ice. Go back to the turn of the century. Anything to add on faceoffs?
No, just drop the puck.
Okay, all right, Grapes.
Or put it there. Let's go.
This from, oh, what a great Twitter handle, Oliver Wallstrom, no matter what. Wallstrom will be a top 10 pick in the draft this
who's
year.
This male or female, what team are they a fan of?
This is from at Canuck Jays.
Oh, yeah,
Oliver Canucks. Wallstrom, no matter what. That's okay. A great one. What is the biggest trade of the summer going to be?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Oh, boy. Is it someone in Ottawa, Elliot Friedman?
Like, Ottawa, I think, has done the smart thing. They've taken a timeout.
Yeah.
But I think Carlson's going to be a big one. You know, if it happens, I'm sure they're all sitting there and saying, is there any way that this can change? So I'm sure they're thinking about that. Ottawa's got, like, a lot of chances there. You know, it could be Hoffman. It could be Carlson. If they decided to do something, they could make the biggest deal of the summer.
Pacioretty?
Pacioretty's a big one. Spezza?
Although, with a new coach coming in, you wonder if that might be
different.
Well,
he's got 1 year left on his contract.
That's right.
Jeff Skinner. I've heard that L.A. has interest in Jeff Skinner. Like, last year, there were blockbusters that came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, what happens if, for argument's sake, and I have no reason to believe this is happening, but what happens if, I mean, first of all, what happens if Tavares turns into a sign and trade? That's your big one. But what happens if, say, Columbus feels that Panarin won't sign there?
Oof.
Like, I think Corey Perry gets one more year in Anaheim at least, but... you know, that could be your answer.
Anyone in Calgary?
I think they're going to try to do something.
That's what I'm feeling, too.
Like, I think there's a lot of interest in Dougie Hamilton.
Oh, don't do it, Calgary. I know anyone's available for the right price. And
yeah,
no one's
it would be
sacred,
a big. It would be a big deal. Like, it would be.
So good.
I think those are probably some of your big ones. Like, the other thing, too, is Winnipeg. What do you think Hellebuck's going to make now? Like, you know Liney's going to be a big number, and you know Trouba's going to be a big number, but all of a sudden you're looking at Hellebuck, and what's his number going to be?
Is this going to be a cap team?
They're going to have no choice. Yeah. Here's the other one. Like, Wheeler is going to be 34 when he signs his new deal. What do you do there? He was on my heart ballot this year.
Yeah. He was great again last night.
Yes.
Okay, we'll end up with this one. Number one Lightning fan, who's the next front office up-and-comer from junior hockey? You know, you mentioned Mark Hunter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was very much of the mind that there would be more teams that would hire people who have specialties like Mark Hunter. And the name I kept coming back to was Warren Reichel of the Windsor Spitfires. Someone you bring into the organization that has a great scouting eye, that knows all the players, you know, has scouted for years. I was very much under the, maybe it's a team like Colorado that goes out and he's a former Av that goes and hires someone like Warren Reichel. I think London's GM, Rob Simpson, might be someone that people would want to have an eyeball on. But I'm going to throw one out at you right now.
Okay.
Here's someone who's right now, he's a senior director of hockey development and special events for the CHL.
Okay.
His name is Joe Birch. You might remember him when he worked for Newport.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he handles things like the Memorial Cup. And you know, it wouldn't surprise anybody that when Dave Branch decides to step aside,
yes,
Dollars to Donuts probably says that Joe Birch would be the next guy. I wonder if the NHL would come calling before that, though. Young executive, real smart, progressive thinker, great communicator, has worked at a couple of different levels of hockey. I wonder if, you know, I really wonder if Joe Birch might be that next guy if you're looking for someone coming out of the junior hockey ranks.
That's a good name. Very good name.
Joe Birch. We'll see him in a few weeks in Regina at the 100th anniversary of the Memorial Cup. We're down to six teams now, Elliot Friedman. Now it gets
really interesting.
It gets very interesting. Best of luck to all those teams. You know what? Actually, you want to mention
other people from junior?
By all means.
You know, Joel Bouchard looks like he's going to the Montreal Canadiens.
Okay, so obviously you're talking about coaching or you're talking about executive?
I don't know what his role, like Dominic Ducharme's on the bench for the Canadiens.
Yep.
Now, Joel.
Blainville's in the final with Acadie
Bathurst. I don't know if he's going to coach or he's going to be an executive. Like, that's the one thing I don't know. Because he's all of them, right?
Yes, with Blainville, Bob Rien.
So I don't know what his role is going to be. Is he going to get a hybrid role of some kind?
Got me.
Yeah.
All right. On that, we will wrap things up. Unless you have anything else to add on this marathon podcast.
No, I'm ready for a nap. That's what I'm going to have to add.
All right. Well, I want to thank Brian Burke for stopping by. I want to thank our producer, Emil Delich, for putting together this Frankenstein monster of a podcast today. Thank you, sir. Complete with edits and music. Speaking of which, taking us out is The Wooden Sky. All right. Awesome. Thanks for your ears. Thank you for the downloads. We'll talk to you next week. 31 Thoughts Pod. Done. That's